You're listening to Portfolio Podcast.
Chris, I am aware of the work that you do in Cambodia, which has been going on for some time now. But can you tell me, walk me back when you started it, what prompted you, and how did you find your way into that village?
One of my best friends is Cambodian. We met in 1993. When I was a banker, and he was setting up a bank in Phnom Penh, which is the capital of Cambodia. And we met and became friends, and he was looking for a chief executive officer for his new bank, and I helped him to find that CEO. After that, I started to go to Cambodia a lot. I used to go into the rural areas. I saw the poverty, saw the problems that the people were having. And for many years, grew to really love Cambodia. And by 2008, we were working together, this friend and I, in Cambodia doing some real estate investment. And we both decided, let's give back, let's do something for the people. So that's how it all started. And then I started to research one specific province, because it was a province which had a high rate of deaths with children and with the people.
Which, of course, you have visited previously, and
yes,
you had some knowledge of what goes on there.
Yes. The reason, one of the main reasons that we went to Kampong Chenang was because there is a very highly trained social entrepreneur there who became our head of operations. And so it's very important when you're working in a developing market that you get a strong team on the ground, because if you get a strong team, confident, experienced, and understand what to do, then it makes the job a lot easier.
And that was the connection that brought you to
us to the province, which is a province of 500,000 people.
Okay.
And it has a river called Tonle Sap River running through it from the northwest to the southeast. And in the northwest, there's a very, very famous lake called Tonle Sap Lake.
Okay, can you just give me, orient me, how far is it from the biggest city or from Phnom Penh?
It's 2 hours by car north-northwest of Phnom Penh.
And what was the road condition when you started going there?
Very bad. So it would take hours and hours to get out of Phnom Penh. The condition of the roads was very bad. It's improved a lot now. Mm-hmm. So the trip can easily be done in about 2 hours to 2.5 hours. And the road conditions are very good. And I would say it's about 65, 70 kilometers from Phnom Penh.
How did you get to identify the problems that you would focus on and help alleviate?
That was done through research, through visiting villages, visiting schools, finding out statistics, which are online. The Cambodian government published statistics on
mortality
rates and rates of diarrhea in children, and lots of statistics. And we very quickly found out that the main problem was the cleanliness of the water. The problem, it's not always that there is a problem with chemicals. It's actually the bacteria and the virus in the water that is killing the children.
So in other words, they didn't have access to potable water or clean water?
No, they didn't. They had a well. Most of the schools have a well. So since 2000, after Pol Pot, a lot of NGOs have been going in and actually
digging wells
in the schools and in the villages. The problem is that the water that comes out of the wells is not clean.
Okay.
And in many cases, there is what they call fecal contamination. It's a contamination from animal and human feces. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's really bad. And that's where, because they don't have toilets, they just go to the toilet in the fields, or they go to the toilet near the river. And then
the bacteria contaminates the water.
Yeah. And then they drink it. And often they try to boil the water, but they don't boil it enough. and you still get the bacteria. The bacteria doesn't get, get
boiling
killed.
The water as
yes,
that's a measure to
as a very simple measure to kill the bacteria.
Yeah.
But the problem is that often they don't boil it for long enough, and then the children and the families get sick. So we came up with a solution, and that was with Olivia Lum at Hyflux to develop a system where the water was filtered through from a tank high up, about 3 meters high, and it was filtered through a Hyflux ultrafiltration filter. And
that must have been an expensive solution or facility to construct. Did you get help from...
Yeah, so we got a lot of help from Hyflux. They helped us to research, to develop a system, because they didn't have a system that we could use in a rural setting.
Mm-hmm.
Most of their filters were for much bigger projects. And so Olivia very kindly offered her research department, and we developed an ultrafiltration system together.
Specifically for us,
which was very
wonderful.
And then we would use these filters starting in the schools, villages, and it worked very effectively. But after about 2 years, we wanted to grow and provide more clean water, because we were only getting 60 litres an hour.
Mm.
So,
and how many of these have you built? The first phase of the...
First phase was about... we started with one village.
Okay.
One village, one school, one health centre, one hospital, one orphanage, and one place of worship. So that was our...
You installed the filter system.
Yeah, exactly. To test, so that we could do a pilot, really, to test whether it works and what we needed to do to improve it. And so we did it in one specific area to make sure that we could then expand and then take it elsewhere. So the first 3 months to 6 months were taken just doing this project. Now that was June 2010. Then, after that, we started really ramping up and putting systems all over many villages. We eventually had 24 villages, and then within 2 years we're up to 100 schools. Now we've got 190 schools, I think.
And how many people, can you tell me, how many people have benefited from this?
Over 200,000.
Wow.
If you imagine that the use of the health centres... A lot of people go to the health centres, and when they go to the health centres, they're also allowed to use to get the clean water.
And then, of course, schools.
And the schools. Every school is between 200 and maybe up to 1,000 kids. And sometimes the schools have a primary, secondary and tertiary, so they actually have maybe 2,000 children. So by putting a system in, which we now today with our new system, we can actually put one in a morning. And then in the afternoon, the children can start using it.
Okay.
So if we were to put, say...
These are not portable systems. I just want to understand the technology.
They're not portable. So we actually... The bicycle system that we now have, we actually secure it into concrete.
And the bicycle is there to pump out the water from the well.
From the well. Yeah, that's correct.
Which goes into the filter.
Yes.
Or
through the filter. And out into a container... And the container is a 20-litre container that has a tap on the bottom. And the children take that container when it's full, and they put it in the classroom, and then they have a dispenser system. And then when it empties, they go out. One of the kids gets on the bike. The other one puts the container underneath, and they collect more water and then put it back in the classroom.
What I like about your project, of course, is the simplicity of it and how easily you can... install and put it to use almost immediately, right?
Yeah, very, very easy to install. And because we've been working for so many years now on this system, we've got a very, very, very much easier to install system. So we don't use concrete basins for washing hands anymore because the concrete takes 2 weeks to harden. So now we put metal. We make metal basins, and they go around a structure which has a tank on top and a bicycle underneath, and then the wash basins around the side.
Uh-huh.
And it means that the whole system is integrated. Hand washing, dental hygiene, clean water, All in one. And the kids absolutely love cycling.
Where do those metal basins come from? Are they manufactured?
We make them ourselves. So we have a workshop. So the foundation has a little workshop in Kampong Chenang.
So your system is actually integrated from the things that you use to how you install them to...
Yes, totally integrated. From day one, when my team, I got 16 people on the ground, and we have metal workers, we've got plumbers, and they go in the morning and they build two systems a week. And those systems have got a big roof on, they have a tank, and they are metal structures. And underneath is a bicycle. We buy half bicycles without the front fork, and then we put a metal tube down through the fork, and it means that we can get bicycles very cheap because we buy in bulk. And then we have our own system for pulleys and for cogs to make the system as perfect as possible. So when the children, even a 10-year-old child, can get on the bicycle and pump up to 500 litres of clean water an hour, which is a lot of water.
I myself would like to get on that bike. Yeah. It's an exercise bike.
It's an exercise bike, and the kids love it. And some of the, especially the boys, when they cycle, can't even see their legs. They're cycling so quickly.
Yeah. And is there more to be done at this point? Tell me first, how much of your target have you achieved?
Yeah. So we've achieved, I would say, about 35-40%.
Okay.
We're close to
the halfway mark.
We're up to around 200 schools, actually more like 40%. There are 549 schools in Kampong Chenang province.
Okay.
And our aim over the next 5 years is that we're going to cover every single school.
Total. Wow.
There are 30 schools that don't have a well, so that we'll have to raise funding.
You said 30 schools.
30 schools do not have a well, so we need to put a well in as well. All the other schools, so all around 510, 515 schools actually have their own wells.
Which is easier.
It's much easier.
Yeah.
We can put a system in one morning.
And then the other 30, you still have to dig the well.
We have to dig a well. But there are specialists. We're not specialists at digging wells, but we know people that can dig wells for us.
Okay,
so
now it seems to me that you, although you are integrated and you're able to do a range of things, you also work with partners. Can you tell me who some of the partners are?
Yes. So our partnerships are absolutely vital, and they're a wonderful addition to what we do, because without partners we wouldn't be able to do what we do. So Hyflux obviously was the first, because they, Olivia and her team, helped us to design the first filter and the second filter, which is used for the bicycle system.
So the second version is an improved...
It's an improved, taller, 1 meter high, much bigger, much stronger filter, which works very well with the bicycles. So that's a great addition, and that's really propelled us from 60 litres an hour to 500 litres an hour. And no need for a generator, no need for electricity, just kids cycling, creating their own clean water.
Wow.
So that's a...
And still very simple. I mean, it's not
still
rocket
very
science.
Simple, no.
But,
and easily maintainable.
Okay.
Easily maintainable.
Important,
very
especially
important,
in remote places.
Exactly. So that's worked very well.
So who else worked with you?
So the KK Hospital.
KK Hospital.
So KK Hospital have been amazing. In about 2012, we realized that the mortality rate for mothers in birth was very, very high, up to 400 per 100,000, which is really astronomical. And we were trying to figure out why that was. And there were really three reasons. One is because the mothers were bleeding too much and they couldn't get to the health center or hospital in time. It's called PPH, postpartum hemorrhage. The second is eclampsia, which is high blood pressure, which creates fitting.
Yes.
And the third one is hygiene, hygiene during labor. So KK came up with a program and they said, we will send a team up to Cambodia, to Kampong Chenang, and we will train your midwives in the province.
Because there must have been midwives already working in the village.
Yes, but the training is not as good as it perhaps should be.
Okay.
So KK went up, and over a three-year period, they trained about 220 midwives, which is almost 100% of the midwives in Kampong Chenang.
Wonderful.
And
is it a continuing training?
It's continuing training. Now they've moved from midwife training to pediatric training.
Oh, okay.
So we have pediatric teams going up now, because we want to lower the mortality rate for children. And so we now have a specialized pediatric training. which includes respiratory
this, pediatric training.
So it's done by KK Hospital,
uh-huh.
and we have the top professors and doctors coming with us. Professor Kenneth Queck,
okay.
who's the CEO of KK Hospital, has been a huge champion for us.
Wonderful.
And Professor Annette Jacobson,
okay.
Who is a Norwegian lady who's been, she was the first person to come with me from KK Hospital to do a reconnaissance trip. Wonderful person. They're all wonderful people at KK Hospital.
And they train local pediatricians?
And they train, yes, so they train the local pediatric nurses and doctors.
Okay.
And that is done under the guidance of Ng Ki Chong, who's the head of emergencies, children's emergency at KK Hospital. So we have incredibly well-qualified teams coming with us. And then they bring other doctors, very, very highly qualified doctors and nurses or midwives with them.
To give the free training.
To give free training. And after the training, we identify the best of the midwives or the best of the pediatric nurses to become trainers. KK train those people to become trainers. So we now have about 20 midwife trainers and about 10 pediatric trainers.
Mm.
And they now do training in Kampong Chenang without KK being there.
Yeah.
And that creates sustainability.
Yeah.
Creates sustainability.
And of course, confidence.
And confidence.
With their own skills.
Yeah. And raise the standards.
How do you assess, for example, the efficacy of say, the training program? Who is in charge of that and who does the check or the assessment?
On the impact?
Yeah.
So it's very, very easy for us to do a check on how well the programs have been running because we know every single health center, and there are 41 health centers. We deal with every single one.
These are government health centers.
They're government health centers, and we have water systems in every one. So we have to deal with them on a daily basis.
Okay, okay.
As a result of that, we always have one midwife from each health center coming to our training. So now all of the midwives have been trained.
Okay.
So we know them. As a result of that, we can get all the statistics from the hospitals and the health centers. And so we see the statistics 3 years ago and the statistics today. And the drop in the mortality rate for mothers in birth is 75%. Real numbers.
You have the statistics to back up.
All the statistics. Every month we get all the statistics.
Yeah.
So we know when a mother dies. We know what she dies of. And so we can work out
over
a period of time and trace and work out
how
what
you have the intervention that's required.
And it shows how key it is to do emergency procedures and to train. And we don't just train theory by showing slides on a projector. We actually do practical training.
Okay.
And the KK team, we take mannequins, we take training aids, mm-hmm. and they actually train on these mannequins to make sure that they understand.
Really rigorous training that
very rigorous
equip
training.
Them with necessary
with the
skills.
And if we feel that they haven't gained those skills sufficiently, we bring them back for post-training.
Ah, okay.
So we continuously train it.
Yeah.
And when we find nurses or midwives that feel that they're not confident enough, we bring them back and we run little training programs for them.
Yeah. But how about livelihood projects? I know that you're involved in some of these. And what is going on now in this project? Like your soap making, for example. That's very interesting.
Yeah, so all of the things we do, I like to look at it as a platform. We have a platform, which is water, healthcare. And from that platform, it's a little bit like you can plug in different specialities.
Mm.
So if we find somebody or a group or a team, an institution that wants to work with us and they fit into what we're doing, whether that be clean water or hygiene, then we can work with them. KK Hospital, Unilever, High Flux, YMCA, and then it creates tremendous synergy and teamwork to bring in specialists that can help to improve the hygiene and standards in Kampong Chenang. So Cha Cha Cottage Foundation, which is run by a lady called Angela Chia.
She's a Singaporean.
She's Singaporean, and she is a professional soap maker. She's been making soap for 30 years.
Okay, this is
interesting. She offered to come for 10 days and run a course for 15 women up in Kampong Chenang to teach them the skills of soap making and eventually candle making as well.
Mm.
Now, why is that so important? One, we can use the soap in the schools, and
as
we can make organic
soap.
It's part of our hygiene program. And two, these women can actually set up their own businesses,
yes,
and become entrepreneurs and sell the soap into the hotels, the tourist industry, and we can also bring in other industries like the pottery industry. So Kampong Chenang is the top pottery center in Cambodia, and we've asked one of the pottery companies if they can make soap dishes that exactly fit the size of the soap
to go with the soap that you manufacture,
and we can sell those to tourists or into the hotel industry, and that gives a livelihood to the women.
Is there a real demand for this soap?
Yes, because it's organic.
Okay.
So normally when you buy soap in a supermarket, it's not really organic. It's got a lot of chemicals in it. So we're making pure organic soap, and we can make it in beautiful fragrances that are from Cambodia. It could be coconut, it could be lemongrass, and we have everything is available to us in Cambodia.
Now, let's be honest. One of the things that we look out for when we buy, for example, a bar of soap is hygiene. It's for hygiene. It has to be made in a clean laboratory, and it has to have a certain standard.
Yes.
Do the soaps pass these standards? And who's
because they're so natural, and all the women wear gloves, so it's hygienic.
Okay.
It's all
part
natural.
Of the training that they
part of the training
Chang Chang.
That everything is very pure. So there's no contamination, or it's all very pure, and they're all taught to wear the gloves and to make sure they put the lids on all of the different fragrances, and so it's the training is very high standard, and in fact Angela makes soap for Raffles Hotel.
Ah, okay.
So the soap quality is very, very high standard. In Singapore, she makes soap for
Raffles. That's a seal of
it's a seal of approval.
Approval.
And so she's a very, very highly qualified trainer, and so it's just another addition to what we do. One of the other areas that we're involved in is empowering young girls to get a tertiary education. So not
that's very important.
It's very important. And
girls in education.
Girls in education. And we're very, very keen to help girls. And also
what's the program here?
So the program is we've taken on a global ambassador, a girl from New York called Carly Bible. She is a YouTube influencer.
Okay.
She has over 5 million subscribers, and she's a makeup specialist, but she agreed that she would like to help the foundation, and what she wants to do, and she's doing it actually as we speak, she's selling bracelets online, on YouTube, on her YouTube vlog, and she's going to donate around $100,000
from the proceeds to
my foundation, and that will be used for a scholarship program for 32 girls every year to go from school into a college to learn to be teachers or to become caregivers or...
Obtain a degree.
Yes, to obtain a degree from a local college, not to go to Phnom Penh.
Mm.
We're always a little bit worried that the girls go off to Phnom Penh and, you know, it can be dangerous. And so
and
to actually...
parental supervision,
yes, exactly.
All of that.
So to keep them in the province, and once they finish their degree... they then go into the province and work in the province. And
that is beautiful.
What we're also looking at is whether they can spend some time with the foundation to do a little bit of work with us to understand what we do so they can spread the word.
How big is the foundation now? You've been doing tremendous work, and it seems that there are programs running simultaneously. How many people do you have?
Yeah, so 16 people. We have a head of operations, a deputy head of operations, accountant. We have a doctor.
All based in
Kampong Chenang. Yeah.
Okay.
We have a midwife, two midwives now. We've got plumbers, metal workers, education.
That's for the water filtration system.
Yeah. So we've got a team that makes the bicycle systems and the hygiene system with the basins. We have teams that go and install. We have teams that educate. We have teams that are constantly going around making sure that our systems are working properly, maintenance teams.
Mm.
So it's a small team for what we do, to be honest.
Yeah. considering the amount of work that you do.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
So there's 16 people, all very motivated. We're like a big family. I'm the only Guaylo.
I didn't know that until you mentioned it.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you something personal. If you look at your life and how you were brought up and your life experiences, I know that you were in the army.
Yes.
What do you think prompted you to start this foundation and what shaped this kind of commitment and faith to start something like this?
When I was young, I joined the army at a very young age and was sent to Belfast, my first really tour of duty, to try and work in Belfast to as a peacekeeper between the Protestants and the Catholics. And I saw a lot of poverty. I saw a lot of distress. And it made me very sad when I saw that. It came of religious turmoil. And then after that, after Germany, I was posted to Oman, Sultanate of Oman. Mm-hmm. And then I saw a lot of distress on the border between Yemen and Oman. There were incidents where Bedou would come over the border, the children were malnourished, and so I again saw poverty, and I think it stuck in my mind, and ever since I've always had the feeling that I'd like to try and do something, and not just piecemeal, but actually start something that could grow,
and with your own hands.
Yeah, and really get into it and make it something that would be generational, that I could hand over, but it would grow forever and not stop, and not just be let's do it for 2 years or let's do it for three years, but to make sure that it actually could sustain itself over the long term. And in about 2006, I was working with a US group, and they had a foundation that championed social entrepreneurs, and I learned about social entrepreneurship, and that fascinated me about how social entrepreneurs work and what they do, and I thought how wonderful this is to be able to actually create something not just for the financial benefit, but to do it for the good of mankind.
That's right.
And so it became a fascination, and then I was extremely fortunate to be given the opportunity to start the foundation in 2008, because my close friend from Cambodia had the financial means to be able to back what was actually originally a venture, not even a foundation. It was a private venture.
Okay. Yeah.
In 2008, it was a venture. No right, no paperwork, we just started it. It became a proper foundation in 2013, in January 2013. So we did it the best way we could. We just got our hands dirty.
Full
we made
commitment.
Mistakes, full commitment with a proper team on the ground, all Cambodians working full time, trying to build water systems, hygiene, and then eventually the medical training. So it became very holistic, and the beauty of it is that as it grew, more and more groups started to want to work with us to help us to improve what we had already.
Mm.
And that's when it becomes very exciting.
I know that you have identified your target and you're very close to halfway to achieving that. What happens when you have fulfilled this? Where are you going to take the foundation, or are you open to looking at other places? Or
I think scalability is important. I think we should try and scale to other areas, but the problem when you scale to other areas with a small team is that you tend to become too wide, and then you're spreading yourself too thin.
Okay.
So my strategy has been always concentrate on one province where we know the area well, we know the villages, we know the districts, the communes, the whole system we know extremely well, we know the people there. Work on that, make it the best of the best in that one province, and then create technical alliances with other provinces or other countries where they come to Kampong Chenang and we
and learn from
we
from
look after them for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, doesn't matter, and we train them to build a system, to maintain a system. We teach them how we go into the villages and how we interact with the people, because that's another important thing I haven't even mentioned, is that when you go into a village or a school, you have to do it with humility. You have to do it on the same level. You have to create a joint venture. And there has to be participation and collaboration on both sides.
With the people.
With the people. It's not giving, giving. We don't give the whole system all in one go. They have to contribute.
They work with you.
They work with us and they contribute to the project as a partner. Now, when you've got that partnership, the whole relationship changes a lot.
Yeah.
Because then you're not, it's not like Big Brother looking down, like a big NGO looking down and not talking to the people, just putting a system in.
They're stakeholders.
They're
stakeholders. Just like you are.
They're stakeholders. Yeah. Exactly. They're stakeholders and they're and because they have skin in the game, they are committed to maintaining, to looking after it, because they put money in.
Mm-hmm.
We say to them they have to contribute by buying the filter, which is $300. So they buy the filter. And every single school, they buy the filter.
Okay, wonderful.
And so that's why we get this tremendous relationships with the local people. But that's something we have to teach people that come from outside as well.
Yeah.
It's not just about putting a system into a school.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work that goes behind that in getting relationship with the headmaster, with the teachers, helping them to understand why we're doing it so that they can educate the children, education programs. And that's when it becomes sustainable.
Was there resistance when in the early days when you were just starting to implement and talk to people what you planned to do?
There was resistance because unfortunately Cambodia, for good or bad, has been give for the last 20 years since Pol Pot, because everybody it was a horrendous situation. They were over 2 million people died, were murdered through Pol Pot. It was a very, very sad country. And so foundations, NGOs, institutions were flying in.
Dumping aid.
Pushing aid. Give. Because they wanted to make the people feel that, you know, we're here to help you.
And wasn't that enough? That a
no,
lot of
because
people
you,
were...
you can't work like that on a long term. Because you have to create an environment or an ecosystem where the people are responsible for the projects, for what they do, and that they become long-term. You can't go to Cambodia and say, oh, I'm here for 2 years. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And then you come out, and you don't have a backup. So you've got to have constant maintenance, looking after the systems, helping, and you've got to be there. We try to get the schools and any of our stakeholders to maintain the systems, to look after them. We still have to be there in the background to help them.
Mm.
And that's where I think the foundation is different, because we really are passionate about being there long term.
Underground.
Yeah. We're never going to be out. We're always on the ground, because every single one of the 16 people that I work with are from the villages.
Ah, okay.
They're not from Phnom Penh or from anywhere else.
They're running their own.
They're doing it for their own people.
That's
they're doing it for their own villages, their own communes.
Mm.
Yeah. That's why it's powerful.
What other challenges did you face when you... This is really an off question, but was language a barrier when you...
For me, no, because my head of operations, my deputy head of operations, spoke good English. So I was able to... I tried to learn Khmer and failed miserably.
Is it a difficult language to learn?
It wouldn't be difficult, I think, if you actually went and lived there for a year or... But when you're in and out, like I am,
okay.
I kind of come back, I forget, I go back, try and speak it again and then come... I mean, I can say hello and how are you and... You know, but I've embarrassingly...
Taxi Khmer.
Yeah. Yeah. But the people are amazing. They're such happy people for the little that they have. They're very, very happy people. So I suppose... What I've faced, there's been ups and downs, because sometimes the systems are broken down. On Tonle Sap River, the water is full of mud and sand, and it can clog up the filters.
And is that seasonal, like a monsoon?
It can be more seasonal, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And when the water gets very muddy, then it clogs up the filter, and we've had a lot of clogging problems. And Tonle Sap River is a very difficult area to work on, because you might have to catch one or two ferries to get across. So logistically, it's more difficult. Yeah. And the water quality is worse there. The main area outside of the river is much easier to deal with, and there are more wells there, so it's easier.
What other areas do you foresee developing? You have livelihood, you have health systems in place, you have healthcare training. Are there other areas that you foresee? You have education, by the way.
Education is the big one that we'd like to push. So one other project we have is that we look after an orphanage, which is
an orphanage
in Cambodia. Okay. It's a government orphanage. It has between 40 and 60 children, and the vision is that every child in that orphanage will guarantee they will get a tertiary education after their schooling.
That is,
as long as they can pass their exams to get to the college, obviously. But we will help them when they... Often what happens in Cambodia is that when they finish their schooling, they don't have the opportunity. Even if they pass the exams, they can't afford to go to university. So I'll give you an example of that. Last October, I went up to... and I visited the orphanage, and there were two girls looking quite miserable. They'd passed their exams to university. One wanted to be a teacher, and one wanted to be a banker. They passed to get into the university, but they didn't have the funds to go. So what our foundation decided to do was to pay for their education.
But these aren't orphans.
They're orphans.
Oh, they're orphans.
Orphan children in the orphanage.
Okay.
Orphanages in Cambodia, often the children are not orphans. Maybe they do have parents, but their parents can't look after them.
Okay.
So they go to the orphanage. But some of them have no parents. A lot of them abandon. Their parents abandon them. So these two girls are now at university studying, one banking, one a teacher.
Wonderful.
In Phnom Penh, being looked after, by the way, by some of the families that are in Phnom Penh of some of our workers, so that they're looked after and there's no worries about their safety.
They have a support system.
We have a support system in Phnom Penh to look after them. And we will do that with every other child that finishes school in the orphanage.
And how is it looking from where you are? Will it happen? What will it take for it to happen?
The
education, the continuing and higher education.
Yeah, we have to build from ground up. We've got to do it slowly. But if you imagine, we've got 32 girls every year now going through a college system, which is being supported by Carly Bible, the YouTube influencer. We've got the orphanage system, and then if we find other children that are in that position, we can very easily... It's cost $300 to send a child to university in Phnom Penh. Of course, there's on top of that is the accommodation and food, but it's not expensive to send a child, and it changes their lives forever.
It's not expensive at all.
No.
But are you reaching out to donors, or how are you funding this whole program?
So the college education and the university scholarship scheme at the orphanage is Carly Bible.
Okay.
The medical, all our medical training has been paid for by Mr. Tang at the Silent Foundation, who's a wonderful Singaporean, a very, very dear friend of mine. And he's sponsoring the medical training with KK for 3 years, $100,000 a year.
Wow.
Which is fantastic.
That's fantastic.
So we have that. And then we have a foundation called Marshall Foundation that are sponsoring 25 schools a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's $1,000 a school. We get a lot of help from different foundations. And that's really great. Tan Chin Tuan Foundation has been helping us over the years with the medical training. It's through friendships and through relationships that, I don't go out actively to look for funding. A few years ago, we ran a dinner. We had a dinner.
Okay. So you
had a charity dinner.
Fundraising.
Yeah, we had a fundraising
event.
With another partner that we have called Jia Foundation, JIA.
Okay.
Yes, with a young girl called Rebecca Lin, who has also looking at water systems in Siem Reap. So we worked with them. We did a joint dinner with them a few years ago. So we've got some very, very strong partners.
Mm.
And we hope to grow as much as we can. We don't want to grow in such a way that we can't control what we have. We want to make sure it's all controllable and that it works.
Mm.
And as you asked before, the scalability comes from us giving technical assistance to other foundations or other institutions want to build the same type of system in their own province or their own country.
And have people, after hearing about this, have they started contacting you or, you know?
Yes, I get contact, like YMCA.
Wanting to get involved.
Involved, yes. Many people. There's 4 young doctors from Kuala Lumpur.
That's amazing.
They came
over
a few weeks ago. Yeah, and they came over to Cambodia and are running a program to help improve the standards of the health centers, whether it be the wastage, whether it be the where the pharmaceuticals are kept, the cleanliness of the health centers.
And they got to know about your ongoing program there.
They did, yes, yes. So we're getting more and more awareness now and people coming forward. 2 groups have done videos for us now over the last 5 years.
That's
the videos are very important because they're awareness videos.
Yes.
I have two now. I have a latest one which was done last year by a group from Taiwan. They came over, they paid themselves, and we looked after them while they were in Cambodia, but they spent about 5 days filming foundation.
Wonderful.
In April, we have a team coming from France, and they're going to do an impact assessment on our water systems for 6 weeks. And
that would
France,
be interesting.
Which is very good. It means that we can actually find out the impact of what we're doing.
Yeah, that's right.
And that team's very important to us. So they contacted us and said, we would like to work with you. And they're doing it for free of charge. It's amazing.
What makes you happy about what you have done?
I get very happy and very fulfilled when I see the impact. Mm. And when I see that people are really benefiting. You know, and these people are, they're really wonderful people. I get very emotional, actually, because I go to Cambodia and I get very touched by the friendship and the way that people react, and they're appreciative of
mm-hmm.
what we do. They're very grateful, but they have very little, but they give a lot, and they deserve to get what we have. Why should they not deserve to get clean water or to get good hygiene or to get good medical services? Everybody deserves that,
and higher education,
and that's, it's simple things that you can do without much money and make massive impact and grow the economy. Ban Ki-moon, he said about 5-6 years ago, he said, for every dollar spent on water and sanitation, you get $7 back in the economy. And that includes helping the people to rise out of the poverty trap and to improve their quality of life. And it's very true. Whether it's $7 or $4, but for every dollar you spend, you get this huge increase in the ability for people to live better lives because they're healthier.
Yeah.
Water's so important. If they don't drink,
they become productive.
They're productive. The kids go to school more often. They don't spend so much money on healthcare.
Yeah.
And health centers and medication because the kids are healthy. And that means a lot. No point in going to a place that has dirty water and teaching them to weave baskets.
Teach them to weave baskets
later, once they're healthy.
Yes.
Give them the basics. Give them
when
clean
the kids
water.
Aren't dying and and
then do the soap making.
The
then
mothers
do the,
are.
Yes. That's the importance. Is do what every human being should have: is clean water, good health, good hygiene, good education, and then just watch everything grow.
Yes.
That's what we try and do.
Congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thanks.